With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Pump man, you ready to go?
I'm ready.
Dude, it's so funny you're wearing, I think, gray, because my first question was, is black your favorite color? Because there was one time I looked at a couple interviews where you were wearing a suit, and I think you said, fuck this, bro. I'm just going gangster style.
That's a costume. 2018.
It was?
Yeah. I up until 2017 or so, pretty much my entire career, I just wore black t-shirts and zip-up hoodies. Like, that's like the Silicon Valley.
I thought it was like a Steve Jobs. I'm not going to do the turtleneck.
Not necessarily Steve Jobs. Just like, I think, it started when I was at Facebook, everyone would wear black t-shirts if you were a product manager. And like, it was just easy. So like, if it's easy and you don't have to think about it, you just keep doing it. And then in 2018, I was like, oh shit, I'm going to start talking to all these Wall Street guys. They don't wear t-shirts. And so I remember saying to myself, like, if I'm going to go in the room, the only way to make them think I'm like them is wear the suit and tie. And so then I would go on TV, suit and tie. I'd go to the meeting, suit and tie. And every day I put it on and I'd say, like, I got the costume on. Like, I'm ready to roll. And then once Bitcoin hit, I was like, all right, I don't need to wear this anymore.
Dude, it's funny you said costume, because so in Vegas, I made a deal that I would wear a suit and tie every single day.
Okay.
And I wore it for a year and a half. And it felt like armor after, because I'd wear it from, I'd be hustling all day to the nightclub at night. But there's certain power to the suit and tie thing, you know, that I see it happens. When I look at your interviews, right, because I'm like, okay, I'm preparing for you, I'm watching your stuff. Everybody, like, they kind of forget the man and they just want the knowledge. Mm-hmm. It's the vibe I get, because everybody's like, fuck, we don't want to know about this guy. Just give us the money thing, money. And I don't know if money brings that to people or the investment side of that. When you're being interviewed, do you ever realize, like, dude, nobody wants to know, like, my favorite kind of food or anything? Like, it's so intense, man.
Well, I don't want to talk about that stuff. I have a friend, we get dinner every weekend, and the joke between me, him, and our wives is no chit-chat.
Really?
What's the point of chit-chat? Like, I go places all the time, people are like, this, whatever. I'm like, what's the substance, right? And part of it is, like, in a social media era, there's actually a lot of chit-chat.
Right.
If you just scroll through an Instagram feed or on Twitter or whatever, people talking about all kinds of nonsense, right? But it's like, when you find someone who's like high insights per minute, you're like, that's the person I want to spend time with. And so when we have dinner with this friend, but also in other conversations in my life, it's just like, how do you optimize for insights per minute? And some people are like, oh, but I don't always want to be on, right? I don't want to be always trying to like learn and all this stuff. Like, that's my hobby.
Right.
I live a real boring life, right? On the weekends, you know what I do? I read. I write. I like that's what I enjoy doing. My wife, thankfully, is the same way. But, like, I don't have some, like, crazy hobby where I'm like, you know what I want to do this weekend? I can't wait to go out on the yacht.
So we're not going to see Pump at the clubs, no?
No. I to this day, I've been to one club one night in Miami. It's just, like, that's just not my thing. And the reason I went is because it was a business partner was, like, hosting the event. And so I made a deal with them. I was like, look, I'll show up, but I'm only going to be there for 30 minutes.
Right.
I have friends who throw dinners all the time and stuff. And like, the joke is that I'm only going to be there for 30 minutes.
Right.
I come, I say hi, I don't eat, I don't do it. I'm just like, hey, I want to be here. I want to support you. I want to, you know, meet whoever you think I should meet and all that. But like, I got other things I got to do. Right. And so it's not because I'm like forced to do it. It's just like, that's what I enjoy doing. And so some people have hobbies that are, you know, really cool in other people's eyes. And some people are like weird. And I guess I'm just like one of the weird people.
No, you're one of the successful people, bro. Reading, right? What are you reading? Like, what do you recommend? What is there? I know you have your newsletter that crushes it, but what is your like go-to read things that you're
so
like?
So I claim that I only read one book per week. I probably read more than that. I probably like 1.5-2 books a week. And a lot of times what will happen is I just will see a book someone recommends, or a friend will give me a book, or like just kind of it's out there somewhere. If I see somebody recommend a book, I buy it. It's the one thing I spend money on. And so literally, you know, my office full of books at home is like piled up everywhere to the point where like, we got to figure something out here. And I just pick the book that, you know, is sitting in the pile of unread. I just go through it real quick. Say, oh, that one looks interesting. Let me start reading it. And so it literally, there's probably like 2 books a day that show up to our house. And when you do that, people are like, hey, like, why would you buy so many books? And it's because, like, I'd rather have more books and then be unread than, like, get to the point where I'm like, oh, I don't have anything that, you know, that I want to go read. And so from the types of books, it's usually either books about people, it's some sort of nonfiction, like business type book, or I enjoy reading about specific events as well. So there's books that have been written about, you know, certain years or time periods or whatever. I don't read any fiction books. I just am not interested in it. And then I have like a very specific process that I go through when I read the book. So I read the physical book. I used to do audiobooks, but now I'm back. I just read physical books.
All right, hold on. Let's stop right there. Okay. Marcus Aurelia book, which I saw you, which is a lot of people are talking about. Okay, so let's go through that. So I'm an audiobook guy, but the smart people like you, first of all, I should have given a disclaimer that you're smartness up here, I'm rarely down here, bro. So you're going to have
It's inverse.
You know, I'm telling you, bro. Trust me, you're up here, right? I want to go through that process. So now you're doing physical, which is the which is the way it's meant to be, right? So that Marcus Aurelius book, talk to me about that. Okay, so first thing you do, you grab it. Okay, now what are we
doing? So the reason why I read the physical books is a friend gave me a book about maybe now over a year ago or so. Handed me a physical book and was like, hey, you should read this book. And I sat down and I tried to read it. And like, I'm not ashamed to admit it, I couldn't read it. Not because I can't read, thankfully, right? But, like, I literally couldn't concentrate. I was checking my phone every 2 seconds. I was looking on the computer. I was like, put it down, let me go get some food. Like, I was just like, what is wrong? Why can't I sit and read this book? And I realized that, like, part of it was, like, a digital addiction, right? Like, I wanted to get on Twitter. I wanted to see what people were talking about. Maybe I'm going to miss something, right? Another part of it was just, like, I didn't practice that skill set or, like, that muscle. And so I was just like, all right, I have to sit down and I have to do this. And so what I used to do is I used to listen to audiobooks on, like, 2x speed. I just mow through them.
No way.
The problem is I wasn't really retaining a ton of the information, and I couldn't go back and actually look at notes or anything like that because I'd be doing other things while I was listening. I'd be working out, walking, whatever. So I said, all right, I'm going to like commit to the physical book. So I get the book, start reading. I highlight, and I'm very liberal with the highlighting. Like if I see something and it's partially interesting, I highlight it.
And yellow highlighter? Yellow?
Different colors.
Different colors?
Yeah.
What do the colors mean?
Nothing.
Oh, okay. Okay. No. Okay.
Once it runs out of ink.
But this is a science, dude. Trust me, people are gonna start. Yeah, it's gonna be the pump strategy. So
trust me, people are constantly giving me, I'm doing it wrong, right? So I just highlight. I finish the book. I then go back, and usually on Sundays are my big day. I sit down. I have the physical book, and I go page by page, and I physically transcribe every single highlight onto a Google Doc. And sometimes these are like 20-page documents, right? So for Marcus Aurelius's Meditations, I think it was literally like 21 pages. And I do that. Then when I get done with the transcription process, I then sit and I basically write notes. And the way that I write the notes is I put at the top, like, hey, here's the main argument of the book. Here's 5 ideas that I can pull out of this book. Then here's a list of like some memorable quotes that don't necessarily fit into those big 5 ideas. And then I write my takeaways, usually like 3 to 5.
What was your takeaway on the book?
I forget exactly all the things I wrote, but like the big thing I think that you can read that book and read it thousands of years after it was written. And you have to remember, one, he's the most powerful guy in the world. Two is he wrote this for himself, not for public consumption. And three, it's all still true.
Really?
Right. And so you're like thousands of years later. And what you realize is like it would make tons of progress on technology and all these different things in society and civilization and productivity and also. Like humans are still humans,
right?
We all still sit there and like we have imposter syndrome. We get overconfident at times, right? We think that like the world revolves around us. Like all those things that you're like, oh, I am so unique and I am the only one who deals with these problems. Like no, literally the most powerful guy in the world thousands of years ago dealt with the same thing and he wrote about it. And so I think like that's like a pretty interesting component. But the reason why that process is so powerful is if you think about what I've done, I read the book. I have to reread as I'm highlighting, so that's the second time. Then I transcribe from the physical book onto the Google Doc, and then when I'm writing the notes, I'm reading back through. So I've at least read every single good part of that book 4 times.
Wow.
And on top of that, I then publish now those notes. I used to not publish them, now I publish them. And then I read into like an audio recording what is written in the notes. So that's 5 times that I've gone over that. Wow. I pretty much remember, I might not remember the specific quotes, but I can tell you almost every single book I've read since I started that process, what the book was about, what are some of the key components or takeaways, and what some of the lessons are. And so then what you start to do is you just over and over and over and over again, week after week, then you start to actually realize, wait a minute, this person's talking about, you know, this topic, and this person's talking about this topic. That's interesting. Why are they all talking about the same thing? And so if you actually think about, you know, let's say Bruce Lee, Marcus Aurelius, and Robert Greene, three people from three different complete times, you know, in history that have different roles. One was a politician, super powerful. Another one was a movie star, and one's an author. All three of those guys spent a lot of time talking about practice. And then you start to look at all these other books, and you're like, wait a minute. Like, practice is this theme that it goes through every single one of these successful people. Sometimes it's intentional practice. Other times it's unintentional practice. But by the time that they are successful, you can look back and you can see that there was a ton of practice.
Dude, let me tell you, I love that you said that, because my number one thing with parents in sports, right, and you're a sports guy, and especially in baseball, is did you play baseball growing up a little bit?
I did.
Okay. What position?
I was a catcher.
Oh, my God. So I could tell. So you're sergeant of the field, guy, whatever, is dealing with failure. Mm-hmm. And I tell parents, I go, listen, what's the first thing you do, no matter what type of plane you board, private, public, whatever, first thing you go through is what? The emergency procedure, right? Because mm-hmm. it's a process. Everything's a process. But parents don't want to do that. Nobody wants to do it anymore, because you want to pay and hack process. You want to pay and hack practice. But it's the reps that gets you there, man. Do you see that a lot as part of your success?
I think in the tech world, there's two things that happen around like laziness. One is the best technologists are actually very lazy. And so what they're constantly doing is like they don't want to do something. So they figure out some way to like automate it, write code, whatever.
Right.
So like in that way, it's like a positive thing. On the other side, like, yeah, there's a lot of people who are like, oh, all my friends, they built these big companies. Like, don't I just raise some money, close my eyes, wake up tomorrow, and like then I have a $1 billion business? I'm like,
right.
No, right? And so I think that's less about any one sector. It's more of just like in general, the society we live in. But also, like, I don't know how different that was than, I don't know, even 100 years ago, right? Like, people still wanted, you know, some sort of fast-paced life. They wanted to reach success quickly. And so if you actually go back and you look, like, a lot of young people didn't want to be tending to the farm, yeah, you know, yeah, where their yeah. father and their grandfather were. Right. They wanted to, like, go somewhere else. And right. so there's this great book called The Rise and Fall of American Growth. And it basically talks about, it's like 1870 to 1940 or so, and how much progress was made there. And so one of the arguments to make in that book is every single home was basically a self-reliant home before this time period. So you had no running water, you had no electricity, you had no connectivity of roads in terms of like paved roads and things like this, and there's no density. There was no telephones. Like, you go through and it's like you actually lived a very, very isolated life, and therefore you had to be self-reliant in terms of your food, taking care of yourself, your safety, like all these things. When you go through that time period, now everything gets connected through plumbing, electricity, telephones, like all this stuff. And so now you can actually start to specialize. So you can be the person who is going to help protect our community. I'll be the person who ends up farming. Somebody else will be the person who creates all the wood working. And now as a community, we can actually coordinate resources. We can produce things. But you want to know one of the most important inventions in that time period in terms of driving economic progress in America?
Well,
the invention of the elevator.
Look at that.
Right? And you don't think about it. And it really what ends up happening is like you read this book and you're like, wait a minute, the elevator was the invention that allowed you to go up. So now rather than have to look at a piece of land and say there's only so much, you know, density we can get here, when you can have the ability to go up,
right,
now you can 5, 10, 20x the amount of people that can live on that piece of land. And so there's little things like that. It's always obvious in hindsight, but like, guess how many people tried to create an elevator or some version of that previously? It's pretty hard. But then if you also go and you look, I've got this huge book in my office that is about 400 pages, I think, or so, of all of the great scientific breakthroughs in history. It's like a really, really big kind of oversized book, and it's all the graphic illustrations. And you go through and you look, and like one of the ones that's really cool to me is the original firefighter truck was literally this thing that got like wheeled out. It had a physical pump on it, right? And it basically could help you put out fires. And so if you watch a movie or whatever, you've mm-hmm. seen these before, right? But like this is the original graphic drawing of it. And you then look at like what fire trucks do today. Like, sure, the technology's improved. It does the same thing.
Yeah, it's
wheels over, it helps put out fires, yeah. and there's a pump, and like you like kind of get through this whole thing. And so like, in some ways, we usually think of practice as for individuals, but also as a society, we practice. And then we look at a fire truck today and we're like, no, that fire truck only exists because we practiced for literally hundreds, yeah. if not thousands of years. And so I think that's just like a long-term trend that humans relearn over and over and over again is like, yeah, of course you're not always right the first time, and practice ends up delivering better results at the end.
I love that, dude. You're so on. Like I wonder, okay, let's take you now versus Cardinal Gibbons, you,
mm-hmm.
okay? Back then, What has changed, man? Have you always been this efficient? Have you been, were you like the guy that was super cool? Were you messing around? Talk to me.
I didn't care. I was a bad kid. Like, bad in the general sense, right? Like, I didn't care about school. When I was a freshman in college, my first semester got a 1.9 GPA. I literally remember talking to the football coach, and he was like, yo, what is going on here, right? And I was like, what do you mean? He's like, how many hours do you study? I was like, what? And he was like, well, go to the library. How many hours do you study? And I was like, I don't know where the library is.
Right.
I spent a whole semester on school. I didn't know where the library
was. What were you doing?
Dude, I was literally a 17-year-old kid who had no one to tell him what to do. I played video games, and I played football.
What video game? What were you playing?
Whatever. Like, it's just like it Madden. Just like, it's like, you know, when you're in high school and you're like, oh, I can't wait to get to college. Like, right. No rules. Like, literally, that's what I went and did. And they were like, hey, dude, no. Like, you can't play football if you go and you do this. And so it's funny, right? Because the second they start to like put some structure around you,
right,
all of a sudden, I don't think I got less than like a 3.6 the rest of the time. But I was fighting out of a hole, right? Because I had the 1.9. And so you like look at this stuff and. What becomes really interesting is if I look back at high school, I was always the same person in terms of, I was always like scheming. I was always finagling. I was always whatever. It's just like I was pointed in a different direction.
Right.
My scheming in high school was like, how do I do as least work as possible and still get by? Because I didn't care, right? Like, I was like, are we really going to have to know the Pythagorean theorem? No, I don't.
Fuck the Pythagorean theorem, bro.
I don't care.
That's like, the worst of all theorem.
I literally don't care. But there was classes where they would have stuff. So like, I remember there was a U.S. government class, right? I paid so much attention. I sat in the front row. I was like locked in. I was like, this is the real shit of life,
this is what
right?
I like.
Like, okay, this is interesting to me. And years later, a kid who is my brother's age texted my brother a photo, and he was like, yo. Your brother is one of the answers in a multiple choice question for this dude's class. And so I was like, that's crazy and weird. So I asked my brother, like, yo, talk to the teacher. And he was like, yeah. He was like, we never could understand why your brother was a complete shithead essentially everywhere else. But he would come in here and he was locked in. And it was like, that interested me. And so when you think about it as like everyone who I am friends with who is super successful, they just are like, I can figure this out, but it's what are they focused on? So they don't give a shit about 90% of stuff,
yeah. But
things they care about, they are locked in. And so I have this like theory that a lot of times whenever I'm facing a problem, I call it jumping the chessboard. So a lot of people are like, oh, play chess, not checkers, right? Which, okay, whatever. But if you think about it, usually actually the biggest breakthroughs in my career have been like, all right, I'm on this board. What if I just jump off this board onto a different board? Like, what's kind of the out of the box way of thinking about this? And what happens is like, that's what I used to do. I did it in high school, I did it in college, whatever. And so in high school, it's like, yo, I'm a junior, only seniors allowed to leave campus. How could we sneak off, get lunch, and come back and not get caught, right? Or like I tell the joke all the time, the first time I ever skipped school is we went and we got the Lil Wayne Carter II album. And then me and my friend, Cameron, we got in a car and drove back to the school and sat in the parking lot and listened to it because we didn't know where else to go. Like idiots.
Listen, you haven't dropped that on any interview you've done. Pull it up. You haven't talked about the Lil Wayne thing. I love it, dude. I love it. Big shout out to Mike Mendez, by the way. Our boy Mike Mendez. He told me, you better give me a shout out. So I'm going to give him a shout out right now.
He's fantastic.
He's the best, dude.
Mendez Fuel. I was on Umarisa. Yeah. Let him start firing off some orders.
Dude, Mendez. I was there today. I got some water. I accidentally walked into one of his gas stations. I shot him a picture. I said, brother, here's your place right here. So cool, man. Your relationship with Pops. Your dad, right? Mm-hmm. You're one of the guys that's known as Anthony, which is very rare. They don't hit you with the Tony, right? But I think he's a Tony because they talk to Tony. How are you similar with him? How did he help you when you were being a shithead and all that stuff? Yeah. Was he a dick about it? Was he cool? Talk to me about that, man.
So I grew up in a family of five boys. And so when you have five boys in a family, like there's only one way to rule the house, right? Is there's no, hey, we're going to talk about things or any of that stuff. And to my parents' credit, I think that they took very much an approach of like they knew when to kind of put their foot down and like, hey, that's out of bounds. And like we got to kind of provide some structure. But also they weren't overbearing. And so, you know, again, we did a lot of dumb stuff like, you know, I'm trying to think of like things that we would do and being a parent of five boys, like you get phone calls all the time.
Right.
Right. And I'll never forget one time my dad said, I think I was a freshman in high school and he got a phone call and the principal of the school. They were Jesuit brothers, I think.
It's a big Catholic school.
Brooklyn guys. So like literally rooms the whole thing. Right. Like, hey, can you come show up? And so he like went into the principal's office and they were like, you know, your son is unique. And he was like, okay, like, you know, did he do something? And they were like, well, like, that's part of the problem. Is like, basically, he goes right up to the line. And then when you turn around, he puts his foot over the line. And then when you turn back around and look at him, he makes sure you know he put his foot over the line, but he pulls it back.
But he pulls it back.
Right?
Look at that.
And so he's not actually like, you know, he's not fighting or like doing anything like super, super crazy, but he's just like a menace.
Really?
Like, basically, I think kind of what he was trying to explain. And, you know, to my parents' credit, I think they were just kind of like, okay, is he breaking rules? No, like, okay, yeah, sure. He's a little, you know, wild or whatever. But a lot of my brothers were that way. And if you kind of fast forward it, it was the perfect way to kind of grow up where you're like, look, yes, there are rules, right? And you got to follow those rules. But at the same time, there's a lot of stuff that happens in life where, like, I got a friend, Jason Williams, who always says, like, management makes rules, management can change the rules.
Mm-hmm.
And when you have that mentality, you're like, look, there are some rules that can't change. But there are a lot of rules in life. And so one of the things that I always joke with founders about is when you get the invoice from a lawyer, did you negotiate? And they're like, what do you mean? I'm like, every lawyer sends the invoice expecting to negotiate with anyone who's experienced in business. So what do? They send the bill and then they expect, you know, 15-20% less. But if you don't know that,
You
just pay the invoice,
you
right?
You pay the invoice.
And you're doing it, you're doing it, you're doing it. And then somebody tells you that and you're like, oh, there's levels.
There's levels.
There's levels to the game, right? Like, okay, got it, cool. Now all of a sudden, once you learn that little piece of information, every time you get an invoice, you're like, bro, I'm not paying that.
Right.
Right? Let's negotiate. And so, like, how do you pick up as many of those little things as possible as quickly as possible? And a lot of times it's just like somebody else figures something out, they're willing to share it. And as you pick up little things here and there, you share. And like, you just kind of keep people around that have a lot of experience. And I think a lot of it comes from being able to operate within the boundaries, but having a lot of leeway in there to be able to figure things out. And you just start to realize, like, at the end of the day, everything's humans, right?
I love
it's
that.
Literally all humans.
I love that.
You're negotiating every day. And now I don't think you're going to go to, you know, Publix and negotiate the price of the carton of eggs. But I do think that there's a whole lot of other things in life that you can just literally talk to people. And whether it's around price, whether it's around the way something operates or whatever, it's just that's how life is. And the faster you realize that, the better off you are.
Pump football. Did you love it? Was that your passion? How were you practiced? Were you one of those guys that was trying to do the least and do the most in the game? Talk to me about that.
So I had two phases to it. I'd never played football before. I think I played like half a season of tackle football. My parents were very much like, you can't play football until you're in high school. And so I played baseball and basketball my entire life. In high school, I think I was the only person in our high school that played football, baseball, and basketball.
Really?
Every year until I graduated. And I'll never forget, I went to freshman year. They had been like working out all summer. There's like a whole pipeline, all stuff. I just like showed up. And my mom brought me and she was like, here's a football field. Like, go tell me you want to play football. Okay. I went out there. And so literally I remember like one of the first practices, you know, you're like a young scrawny freshman. They're like, all right, we're going to punt the ball. The punt return's going to get practice. Like, run down there and try to tackle him. Sweet. I'm, you know, above average athletic.
Right.
And like, I can just go hit him. Like you don't care. I'm like, no, that's the point. I'm like, awesome. Ran down and a junior on the football team literally clotheslined me. This dude, EJ Roscoe, he was like probably like 6'1", 250 pounds. He just stuck his arm out and just clotheslined me.
Wow.
And I remember being like, oh boy, like maybe next time, lesson learned, like don't run into that.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So you start to like learn very quickly. And so my freshman year, I don't think I played a single down. I don't think I won in a game. Never played football before. I was figuring all this out. By the time I was a sophomore, I was playing on varsity. And it was just like, I was just obsessed. I was like, how do I get better at this? Right. And so I started working out. I started to go and do all the running things. I spent a bunch of time trying to learn from the older guys, like all this stuff. And so, throughout my entire football career, I wanted to do everything. I remember literally getting in an argument with the coach one time. The quarterback had gotten hurt. I was like, coach, I can play quarterback. And he was like, no, dude. And I was like, coach, give me the ball. I will play quarterback. And so there's a highlight tape that I sent out to college coaches where I pretty much knew at some point, like, okay, I'm getting good at this. And I don't think if I remember correctly, I think I tied the state record for interceptions in a year when I was a junior.
Nice.
Which was, okay, we're on the way. And then some kid went and he broke it that year. And so I remember being like, oh, again, it's outside of our league, outside of this. Like, there's different levels to
right.
this. But when I was a junior, that's when I realized, like, this is the ticket out of here. right, is I don't have the grades to get into some of these schools. But I started to talk to Ivy League schools, started talking to Patriot League schools, started talking to the coaches at Duke, and June Jones was at Hawaii, and like all these different schools. And I was like, oh, these dudes are literally going to get me into this school because of what happens on this field, not what happens in that classroom.
Yeah.
And like, whether it's right or wrong, whatever, like that's the way the system works. You better make sure you get into one of these schools. And so I ended up going to Bucknell. And like, you know, it's easy to go visit in the early fall when it's nice out and all stuff. And then you get there and it's snowing sideways and you're like, oh shit, what did I do? But yeah, that was the whole thing. And really it just came down to like, if I can get into one of these schools using this as the ticket, I don't think I ever was confused. Like I'm gonna go play in the NFL or anything like that. But when I did it, I took pride in it. And so it like very much went from like, I don't know how to do this to like, hey, I want to be good at this.
I want to be good at this.
And so it's something I had a lot of fun doing and it got me into school. So like it did its job.
Dude, like I see you football, something where you're like head on a swivel, right? Then you go to the military, head on a swivel also. That's like crazy. Military life, was it what you expected? Was it like, were you like, oh my God, what am I doing? Or you're like, do you know what? This is going to help me in the long run.
There's no like black and white when it comes to that stuff, right? So I was 17. I graduated a semester early from high school. I went to basic training.
Because you were smart? So you graduated early because you were just smart?
No, because I needed to get out of there. Really? Yeah, I was like, yeah.
It's funny you say, so I'm going to talk to a kid today. I get kids reach out to me all the time. As a kid, 10th grade, his mom's telling me like he doesn't want to go to school anymore. Like, you know, he wants to be an entrepreneur, but they don't know what his dad
is. Yeah, it's hard in high school to do
so that. I'm like, but you said you had to get out of there.
So I was a junior. I knew I was going to go play football. Like I had enough interest where it was like, I don't know if I'm going to go play at Clemson, right? Or like at Alabama. I don't think that's going to happen. But like, I may go play at Duke down the street, or I may go to Brown or Brownell or like whatever, right? And so I felt pretty confident like I was going to go somewhere. The signing day is in February. But if you're going to graduate, you got to kind of pre-plan it. And so I went to them and I had read a bunch about football players who had graduated in December of their
that
senior
reading,
year.
Dude, that reading.
and I was just like, that sounds cool. Like, why are they doing that? And it's because they would go to the college campus in the second semester of their senior year of high school. They would get a bunch of credits done so that during football season as a freshman, it was a lighter load because they'd already done some of the work. And so it was like a nice, easy transition into college. I was like, that sounds cool. Problem was I didn't know what I was gonna do, and some of these schools, like Duke was a good example, they were like, hey man, we like you, I don't know if we're gonna have a scholarship for you,
right?
You're gonna be a walk-on, right? Like, we gotta wait to signing day to see, maybe a guy that we're gonna give a scholarship to doesn't take it, he goes somewhere else, the spot opens up,
right?
So I was kind of like what they call it, like on the bubble, if you
a little iffy. That's too iffy.
Yeah. And so I graduated, I was literally working two jobs, Quiznos and Chick-fil-A, and I was like, bro, I'm going to work every day. Like, shit was fun. It was cool, whatever. My friends are in school. I'm like, you guys are suckers. I'm making money, whatever. And then I looked around one day and I was like, holy shit, if I don't get out of here, like, I literally, there's a 35-year-old guy who's working next to me at Quiznos. And like, I'll never forget, he walked in and hit this big bandage on his hand. And this is literally insane. And he was kind of like one of those guys where you're like, hey, man, like, I'll talk to you at work, but like, I'm not going to hang out with you on the weekends. And I was like, what happened to your hand? And he was like, my girlfriend stabbed it. Or something. Like, he said something where I was like, oh, bro, you live a different life than me. Like, that's not even a worry in my life, right? Like, all right, like, I hope you're okay, but I'm going to try to figure something else out. And so there was a military recruiter who walked in. They had, like, these little pamphlets or whatever there. I remember just being like, yo, what's up with that? And he kind of gave me, like, a quick pitch or whatever. He walked out. And so I ended up going to see him. And I just remember walking in and be like, yo, y'all need help? And being like, yeah, dude, this is a recruiting station. Like, we definitely should talk.
Right.
And at the time, they were paying $20,000 signing bonus for anyone who joined. I was a 17-year-old kid. You're going to pay me $20,000 to go shoot guns, jump out of planes. Like,
and get in shape, stay in shape. The whole
thing. Your parents got to sign off. Oh. Went to my dad. He was like, bro, I ain't making this decision. Go talk to your mom. And at first, she was like very against it. But I think she kind of warmed up to the idea of like, it's going to be discipline. You're going to get all the structure, whatever. And we figured out how I could go do it and still be able to go to school in the fall for freshman year. So I did that freshman, sophomore year. Everything's fine. But I'm doing football. I'm going to school. And then I've got to do the reserve duty, which is like kind of a little bit of a nightmare, right? So sometimes I would go like Friday to reserve duty, then go to practice Friday night, then go to the game on Saturday, then after the game, go to the reserve duty, and then on Sunday, go to the reserve duty. It was just like it was a nightmare. And so I go through all that. Then when I was a junior, 2 weeks into school, they call me and they're like, yo, you're going to Iraq. And I was like, yeah, I'll catch y'all later. Like, good luck, right? Like, let me know how it goes. Send me photos. Nope, you're going. And I had a withdrawal from school, got deployed, spent a year over there, came back. Three semesters had passed, and now all my friends were leaving school.
Wow.
Right, so they're all graduating. I'm now back on campus, and I always credit, there's a lot of guys that I went over there with who, there's like three buckets. Some guys, you know, did fine in transition back. Some guys were real, real screwed up. And then there's this like middle group where like it wasn't super easy, but they kind of got through it. And I ended up being in the group of like, it was a pretty easy transition back. But in hindsight, I went from a group of guys, all wear a uniform, combat, you know, combat sport type situation, very much us versus them, like all these different things, to then into the military, they just give you a gun, essentially, right? But like very similar dynamics.
Right.
And then there was like almost like a off-ramp the same way, because I went back to play football. So again, I went back, they basically just took the guns out of our hands, and they're like, hey, here's your uniform, here's your group of guys, it's you versus them, it's this like violent sport, whatever, and then you kind of go into society. And so in hindsight, that was like a really, really helpful thing for me. But that experience was probably the single most powerful kind of experience I had, because what you realize is like, I was 20 years old when I turned 21 over there. I'm there with like men. Right. Like these dudes are they got mortgages and kids and wives and like all this stuff. I'm like, dude, I was worried about what party is going to happen on Friday night. Like, what do you mean a mortgage?
Yeah.
And they're like, bro, this is real life. Like, kind of, you know, get up with it. And so when I went back to school, I took it very seriously then. And that's when I was like, oh, shit, all these kids run around, you know, just getting drunk all the time and everything. Like, I want to have fun, too. But like, there's something after this. I got a shot clock here. I better figure something out.
The talent you have for finance and all that. Did you know that was coming? Are you just applying the same principles to this thing now? How did that treat you? Because you're like the guy, bro. And people, like I said, people don't small talk you. It's literally, hey, we have our man Pomp here, and it's like, Pomp, give us information. We predict. Talk to me about that, man. How did you start getting comfortable in that? What intrigued you about that?
I literally just read a lot, and I talk to a lot of people. And just the faster I could do that with high quality information, you just learn it, right? And so a lot of times people hear me like say all this data or whatever, and they're like, how do you know that? I'm like, well, I read it somewhere,
read it.
Right? Or I knew someone, I was talking to them, they told me about it when I found it or whatever. And then I think I just have a really good memory. I have no clue why, but like I can remember very specific data points and facts, and I could literally tell you the exact month that inflation went over 5%, how long it's been above 5%, like all this like crazy stuff. But it's not like a photographic memory or anything. It's just that like when you care about something, you remember it.
Yeah.
Right. And so I'm fascinated by how all this stuff works. And then I think that when you take somebody who has like, I'm not smarter than anyone else when it comes to the information. I just read a lot, talk to a lot of people, and I'm able to retain it. But then I've been willing to make a number of like pretty contrarian bets and say it publicly. There's plenty of people who make tons of, you know, kind of against the grain bets, if you will. But they won't go on Twitter and talk about it, right? And then when, you know, take Bitcoin as an example, when it crashes, they all disappear. It's like rats when the lights get turned on.
Yeah.
They just run away, right? And, you know, in 2018, this past year as well, like, I'm happy to talk about it, right? And if I'm wrong and I think I'm wrong, I'll just say, hey, yeah, I was wrong on that. Okay, let's move on to the next thing, right? If I don't think I'm wrong, but everyone else does, I love that.
That's a good.
Right? Because that's where the opportunity is. And so I've told this story before, but there's a guy on Wall Street, legend, managed over $100 billion, built this massive asset management firm. Everyone respects, you know, when he talks, they listen. And I went to go see him in 2018 with my friend Mark Yusko, and I'm sitting there talking to this guy, 15-minute meeting. We're talking about Bitcoin. He don't give a shit. Like, he's just like, yep, nice to meet you. Okay, great. Basically took the meeting because of Mark, right? Talking to him about his kids or whatever. He goes, okay, thanks so much. We'll think about it. Like, see you later. And we walked outside, and I could tell that Mark was a little bummed. And I was like, you good? And he was like, yeah, you know, I thought he was going to be more excited about it. And I was like, no, Mark, I'm pumped right now. That's the opportunity. This dude is the old guard. He doesn't think this is going to work.
I don't see it.
If it works, that's where the new folks can come in and 100%. Arbitrage this before he ends up figuring it out. And so you just got to have a balance between, like, you got to understand the fundamentals and the principles of timeless investing and all that stuff. But if you also can then be kind of in tune with some of the new stuff, you just kind of sit and straddle that line. And so I say that people between the ages of like 28 and 40, probably, like, we didn't have cell phones growing up, but we got them in high school. So we got them literally close enough to the point where, like, we could use them.
Yeah.
But I remember, like, life before, on AOL, and my mom and dad are like, get the hell off the internet. I'm trying. My friend's supposed to call me.
Right.
Or vice versa. Like, so it's just, I don't know. It's just timing, and just use what you have, you know, to your advantage.
Dude, to now that you have like Elon retweeting you or talking to that, when that happens, are you like, holy shit, or are you like, oh, it's about time?
No, definitely not about time. No, I mean, look, it's you know what Elon's probably doing when he does that? He's probably taking a shit.
Right.
Right? Like, guess what? Everyone does it, right? Right. They're playing on their phone and in the bathroom or whatever. Then they're, like, waiting at in an elevator. They won't talk to anybody, so you just pull out your phone. Like, it's become this, like veil where now you don't have to interact with people in public. Right, you just pull out your phone, right? You're waiting in line at the coffee shop. Pull out your phone, mm-hmm. right? That's probably what he's doing.
Right.
Right? Is he's got a couple minutes. He's, like, bored or whatever, so he just pulls out his phone. He scrolls through, and he retweets it or whatever. And so I tend to think that, like, we over-index on how important these people are online, but we under-index how important they are in, like, the real world. So you think of Elon's a perfect example. Everyone is obsessed with Elon on Twitter and, like, did he reply? Did he do this, whatever? Like, who cares? Nobody cares about that, right?
Right.
In actual reality. But in the real world, like, the dude is the GOAT. I went and I looked at the numbers. He has averaged a multi-billion dollar company every single 5.5 years for 30 years.
Yeah.
It's insane, right? No one in history has ever done this before.
Crazy.
And so when you look at that, you're like, man, we should probably celebrate more what he's actually doing in the real world and care less about, like, what tweet he had or whatever.
Yeah, of course.
And you just go across all these industries, it's the same thing. And so you just got to remember, like, Twitter's not real life. Instagram's not real life, whatever. Use it. Use it as a tool, but be able to put the tool down, right? Which goes back to kind of being able to literally, I have this challenge to people. I say, take a physical book, sit down for 1 hour, don't touch your phone. And be honest with yourself, could you do it?
Yeah.
Most people can't.
That's hard. You said in an interview once that to reach strange people, weird people, you can't be serious. Your ability to enter social media and be you, right? Not too many people can do that.
Because they're scared,
or they don't want to be vulnerable, whatever. Have you been scared before? Did you talk to yourself? Listen, I'm excited to talk about this. Because for me personally, with me, and I get this with so many people, I shared like an example that with my dad beating the shit out of me when I was real young, I'm wetting the bed at the age 13, 14, which is not normal.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't know it was that. Mm-hmm. So I felt that if I started talking about that, and that's happening, some other kid would be like, oh, wait a minute, this. And it's helped a lot of parents to, like, I'm doing that to my kid now to stop, right? But you now coming on with social media, with a show, and with all this stuff, man, how has that helped you? Were you like, I'm born for this? Did you adjust? How did you feel about that?
I mean, there's multiple ways to think about this. One is if you talk to me, my wife, my brothers, like people around us, like maybe we should be a little bit more strategic about some of the things that we do. Cause I mean, there's definitely times where like myself, one of my brothers, whatever, like just tweet something and then like immediately we're like, yeah. Like if you tweet, hit the tweet button, then you get a phone call immediately. Right. We all got notifications turned on. If you're like, yeah. What are you good over there? Right. And so like there's not a lot of strategy that goes into that type of kind of like offhand stuff.
Right.
But there's a ton of strategy that goes into like the more thoughtful content. And you know, the number one golden rule of Twitter is like the dumbest content goes the most viral.
Right.
So like you tweet something stupid, it's going.
You
spend 3 hours trying to craft the perfect tweet and it a dud. Right. And so like you just gotta kinda say like, hey, that's the internet, that's the algorithm. But in terms of also like thinking through all this stuff, it is wild to me. I can have a TV show with this.
Yeah.
Like I could literally compete with ESPN.
Yeah.
With CNBC, with all these people, like, yo, they fucked up. Like, they shouldn't have let us have phones, right? Right? Like, when you think of it from that perspective, it's like, man, that's pretty powerful.
Yeah.
Now, what do you do? How serious do you take it? What's the end goal? Like there's a lot of nuance in there. And there's a downside. There's a huge downside to it, right? So, you know, there's a bunch of things that I used to do. And over time, I realized where the downsides were. And I pulled back. So I don't talk about certain things online, right? And most people, like, don't talk about politics. I don't give a shit about that stuff. But, like, I don't talk about, like, super personal things.
Right.
Because it just there's no upside to it, right? I don't tweet photos from places that I am while I'm still there.
That's smart, obviously.
Right? Because it's just, like, a physical security thing.
Right.
And so, like, you, like, come up with all these, like, little tiny things here and there, which is, like, what makes you comfortable.
Right.
At the same time, though, like, I have met more people on the internet that are super high quality than I would have met anywhere else.
Absolutely.
And now what I realize is I have this like immense leverage. I think it's Naval has this idea of like capital, code, or media are the three like leverages that you can use in the digital age. And so I don't think I ever understood the leverage that media provides until I started to build a lot of companies and do all this stuff. And then I would get on the phone with somebody and they're like, bro, I know you. Like, who are you? And like, no, dude, you don't understand. For 5 years, I've been following you. I know everything about your life.
Right.
Oh, shit. Okay. Little weird. Same time, super powerful. And so what you realize is it's like one to many communication, and you get this leverage. And so you want to use the tools, right? I don't think it makes sense. Like, I'm going to get off the internet and not use a phone, like be a monk. But at the same time, you just want to do it for the right reasons.
Right.
And so one of the trajectories a lot of people go through when they're getting onto the internet, right, whatever that means today, is like if you're doing it for the likes, that's the dopamine hit in the early days.
Got it.
Eventually you hit a tipping point. You're like, that shit don't matter.
Right.
Now it's easy to say when you got a lot of followers, a lot of, you know, engagement, and like all this stuff. But like you just begin to realize like my life is not any better if I get, you know, 10 more followers or whatever. Instead, what you start to realize is like, no, I would actually take a smaller audience to have the right audience,
right,
that the people I want to engage with, because the bigger the audience gets, the percentage of trolls gets bigger too.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
The scrutiny gets bigger, like all these things. And so if you go and you talk to a lot of folks who have their real names and their real identities online, and you said to them, you can have the same exact success that you have today, but you could have done it pseudonymously. I think most of them would say they'd do it pseudonymously, but it's hard to run that experiment.
Dude,
right?
It's like those players, there's certain players, the athletes that we know that were good, but they could walk down the street and nobody bothers them.
Yes.
And there's other ones that can't go take two steps because it's, so it's exactly what you said there. Our boy Dave Porn is coming back with DDTG, Davy Day Trader Global. I think it starts March 1st, man. What do you think of that? That's hilarious. That's funny. What's your take on DDTG coming back?
I don't know anything about that specifically coming back, but during the pandemic when Dave was trading stocks, I loved it, right? I mean, one of the beautiful things about art and about media is you're trying to break through the noise, right? You're trying to stand out. You're trying to kind of cut through all the nonsense.
Right.
And one of the things he kept saying over and over and over again was stocks only go up. And now, by the way, Warren Buffett says the same thing. And so does all these other people. Now, they're talking about 30, 40, 50-year time frames.
Right, right.
Right? He was talking about like, no, literally just always goes up. Now, if he had said stocks always go up when they're printing money, I don't think anyone would have had a problem with it.
Right.
But again, is it all about having the pinpoint accuracy and fine print, or is it about getting your message through?
Getting the
right?
message out.
And so I remember two specific moments. He went on CNBC, had a cigar in his mouth, and he was like, I'm the king of Wall Street. And people in the legacy financial world, where they were literally like steam coming out of their ears, right? And they're like, well, who is this guy? What does he think he's doing? Whatever, whatever. But it was like, no, you don't understand. Literally, this guy just showed up and he's making a ton of money.
Right.
Because he understands something that you all won't admit.
Right.
You all still think that you're some genius because you're picking stocks. He's literally like, just get long and loud when they're printing money.
Yeah.
And he was right.
Yeah.
The second thing was he was picking the letters out of the
that was
Scrabble
the best.
Bag.
That was the best.
Right? And like, you know, I did a podcast with him. He was like, they didn't see me coming. Like, no shit, right? Like, you're literally taking random Scrabble letters out of a bag and buying tickers.
Yeah.
But again, it was a perfect way to articulate or visualize this thing he was saying, which was like, these people are printing money and stocks will just continue to go up until they stop.
Right.
Now, if you look at it, he walked away pretty much when he should have.
Right. Right.
And so like the return.
That's it.
I mean, look, the guy's a good market timer. He's coming back pretty much after everything drew down.
Smart,
right?
Smart dude.
It's pretty easy if you get out at the top and come back at the
bottom.
That's
how you do it. That's how you do it. You come back when the team's stacked. If not, you take the year off.
Now, the one thing I will say is in 2016, I think it was, I wrote a blog post about Barstool. They had raised a little bit of money from Peter Chernin and the Chernin Group at a $15 million valuation. And people thought I was nuts for this. But I wrote this thing. I said, it's going to be a $1 billion company. And everyone was like, it's crazy, whatever. Now, again, fortunate, I was in college right when they were hitting in the Northeast, right? And kind of you could see
how crazy the
audience was, the blackout tour. They would come to the campus and people go nuts and like all this stuff, right? So you knew the engagement was real, the fan base was real, like all this. And it was very clear. And even Dave would say, like,
right,
there was checks laying around the office that were uncashed. Like, he was like, I'm not the business guy. Like, I'm definitely the content guy.
Right.
And so they were bringing in professional help to come and do that. And so as they were doing it, I said, look, if they execute this plan where they bring on other talent other than just Dave, if they go into other verticals than just this like hardcore sports angle, if they can professionalize it with an executive team, if they can do all this, like, it's going to be a $1 billion company.
Yeah.
Now, I think it ended up being $650 million. Yeah. But I ended that piece and I was like, as long as Dave doesn't sell too early. Right. And so, like, that's the one thing. I love Dave to death. I think he's literally probably the media pioneer of this entire generation.
Yeah.
People hate that. Like, yeah. They hate that guy. Right. They want to yell and scream at him. The mob wants to come after him, whatever. But like, name somebody else who has stood there when the mob's coming at him. And he's just been like, I'll talk about it.
No, and spitting facts left and right. Okay, right? Let's talk about it. Yeah, yeah.
And I think he'd be the first person to say, like, he's not always right.
Right.
All these companies, right? All these kind of new age digital media companies, there's YouTubers, there's things like Barstool Sports, there's even like The Ringer or whatever.
Right.
When you look at them, like, it's just a level of authenticity that you can't get on television or you couldn't get in the newspaper or the magazines. Because now what happens is you're giving the talent the direct communication to the audience. There is no producer sitting there saying like, oh, don't say that. Or yeah. Here's the talking points or here's this. Like, I mean, I don't remember if you remember during the pandemic, like Dave was doing like the unboxings.
That was the best.
You are a star if you can turn the camera on and for 3 to 4 hours hold people's attention and open up boxes of packages.
Yeah, the best.
You're a star.
The best.
Right?
The best.
And so when you see that, you have to say to yourself, like, whatever critiques you want of people, all this stuff, like, that is the new media world.
Yeah.
Is the stars don't want to be on television anymore.
Yeah.
They want to have a phone or a camera in their face and they want to just say, just film me. I'll take care of it. And that's what we see. And now there's all these viral stars all over the place and stuff.
Right.
And what you realize is when you democratize it, actually the internet's better at finding the stars than the producers or the bookers were at putting people on television. And so
Yes. Game
on. Now it's a free market. Let's see who's good.
Dude, I can't agree with you more. You now with your show, right? How, because now you went from talent to interviewer and stuff like that. Talk to me about your process as an interviewer. As a podcaster, how do you think about that? Or like your prep for that versus when you go on, when you've been on podcast before, are you like, oh my God, this shit sucks?
What prep did we do today?
Me and you?
Yeah.
No, I did prep for you.
You may have done prep.
No, not when you're coming on. You don't know when we're coming on.
We didn't talk. We didn't do anything right.
Me and you are like ESP.
Usually when I come in to do an interview, I know who the person is, right? I invite them on the podcast, whatever. And right before the interview, I say, hey, what would be helpful for you? What would be, what do you want to talk about? And they'll say like, oh, you know, I got a new book coming out or I got this or whatever.
Right.
That's the only guidance.
Nice.
I almost never have notes, right? And I just shoot because I'm genuinely curious.
Right.
And, you know, if there's sometimes where like it's a really big guest or somebody who's like very complicated in the sense of they have a lot of controversy and I want to make sure I get the details right, or they got a lot of stuff going on and I want to make sure I don't get done with the interview like, oh damn, I should have asked them about
this.
I might have some bullet points or something, but for the most part, like, I just sit down and I just talk with people.
That's what I do. Like, I have certain stuff there, but it's just I get so excited that I don't want to forget.
Yes.
You know,
so I think that there's two types of conversations you can have. There's like the very like planned conversation, and then there's the like more genuine curious conversation. The problem with most business people is they're very polished. And so what ends up happening is they're like media trained, whether, formally or not. And so it's very hard to get them to have an interesting conversation because they just want to keep sticking to their talking points.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so what you end up finding is you can do one of two things. You can have a genuine, curious conversation where there's this like level of humanity to it. And they realize, oh, he really cares about this. He wants to learn. And they kind of open up. Or you can do what my buddy Sam Parr does, which is like in the middle of the interview, you just blur out like, how much money is in your bank account?
Right? Yeah, or you just throw them off.
Just not even to throw them off. Just like you just ask questions that no one else would ask.
Right, right.
And then if they don't want to answer, they'd be like, oh, I don't want to answer that. Right. But they also may be like, $2 million. And then you're like, holy shit.
He answered.
And so I always think about as the interviewer, if the conversation is good, it's because the interviewer asked good questions.
Right.
If the conversation is not good, it's the interviewer's fault. It's not
the person. No, never the person. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right? And so my wife and I talk about it a lot, maybe even her idea, of like the quality of the conversation is driven by the quality of the questions. And therefore, when we have like dinners and stuff with friends, like, again, no chit chat. It's like, hey, let's talk about things that are actually meaningful, that we enjoy talking about, that we're going to learn from each other, like all this stuff. And so when you go into it with that mindset, I joke with the couple that we have dinner with every weekend. I'm like, yo, we should send notes to each other beforehand, almost like an agenda.
Yeah.
We got to talk about this, and this.
You would do that, huh? You would.
We 100% over text. Like, it's like, yo, let's make sure we talk about these three things.
So we're prepared. Tonight.
And I like that. Some people are like, dude, like, just chill out.
Right.
I'm like, no, you don't understand. You go and on Sunday, you're watching football with your friends and like drinking beer and stuff. I went with my friends and we had this like intellectual war and talked about all these ideas. And sometimes we agree wholeheartedly. And other times I'm like, yo, you're a moron. Right. Here's why.
Right.
And everything in between. And like, that's the beauty of these conversations is like, you want to surround yourself with people who not only are smart, who not only are like introspective, but also are willing to have the conversation.
Yes. That's important.
Cause a lot of people are just like, they want
to dance. You got to dance, you know, not correct. Shut it off and do it there. How do you pick your guests, man? Is it stuff, people you like, some you see, like, oh, I like that person's thing. How do you do that?
People I want to talk to.
People I want to talk to.
Yeah. I mean, it's the greatest excuse ever to get people to come talk to you.
Yeah.
Right? Is I'll message somebody and I'll say, hey, I got this podcast. Basically, it's a trade. I don't position it that way, but it's a trade. Come talk to me and let me learn from you, and then I'll blast the conversation out to all these people. Right? And so in some way, like, come on my podcast has become a known thing. You don't have to explain it. But yeah, it's just like, who am I interested in talking to? And there's a balance. Like, sometimes we know we're going to interview a guest that the audience isn't going to care about, but I want to talk to them.
Yeah.
And every once in a while you do that interview and next thing you know, it explodes because the audience is like, yo, I didn't know you knew this person, or I didn't know were interested in this topic, but I'm interested as well. And so I try not to think too much about like how the audience is going to receive it. And I just try to think about like, are you an interesting person? Can we have an interesting conversation? And is it something that like I want to talk about for a long period of time? Then I'll do it. And then we just don't take that many inbound.
Dude, I love that. After you, I think I'm going to have the top fertility doctor who I worked with his kids. Great dude. Because that kind of stuff that happens to me that I think can help people, I love doing that also, you know? That's why, bro, I love having a guy like you on, because you're one of the few guys that I've experienced that in the short amount of time that I've known you that has said something and has followed through with it, which to me, that is huge, man, because I think people out here are like in fucking Disney World, bro. These hocus pocus, they're saying shit that they don't follow through, dude. Two last questions, man.
Can I say something on that topic real quick? There's a video that's going viral right now that I think is the perfect epitome of this idea. There's a Navy SEAL. His name's Chad Mann, I think, or Chad something. And he's got like long hair, a beard.
I've interviewed him on the show. I know him.
Okay. All right. So
Chad Witzik or something like that.
So
he's a runner with a real long beard. Yes.
Yeah.
I've had him on.
He's got this video. He's doing an interview recently, and he said he was the breacher in the SEAL teams. And so basically what the breacher does is they build a explosive to breach a wall or a door when they're going to go on a raid, right? So, hey, there's a guy in there we want to capture. Well, we got to get into the building. Mm-hmm. And obviously they're not going to, like, knock and open the door, right? So you got to bust into the building. And so what he does is he's the first man in that mission to get up there and kind of patrolling in. He's the point guy. Because he's the one with the explosive, so he's going to be the first guy to get that door. He basically slaps it on there, right? And then he turns. And before chaos kicks off, usually it's pretty peaceful. It's in the dark at night. People are sleeping, like an element of surprise, all this stuff. There's three words that you say. Execute, execute, execute. And on that third one, you freaking pull that thing and game on. Bullets start flying, explosions, like we're here to do a job. And so what I think a lot about is in the military, they talk about violence of action. And the way he describes it is like those three words people should take to heart. Execute, 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 right? How many people are dreamers or thinkers or, you know, doing all this other stuff and like, oh, I should do this, or I wish one day, or that, like, just go do the shit, right? And so if you always have that execution mindset, like, you will make mistakes, and sometimes you'll execute when maybe you should have planned a little more, but you'd rather miss to having the, you know, kind of propensity of action than to miss on the planning side. And so I just think all the time now, ever since I saw that video, I was like, man, execute, 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 just keeps you going.
He's interesting, dude. He does running, and he's awesome because he runs and outruns everybody, but he does it like in regular clothes.
You know, like, bro, if you're a Navy SEAL breach man and you're on the point of the patrol, you ain't exactly gonna just retire and sit in a recliner.
Like, these people, it's just crazy, bro. He is crazy. You have a big event coming up. Talk about that.
Yes. Lyceum Miami. So on March 4th in Miami Beach, I basically just went and got a bunch of people who've been on the podcast before, a couple special guests.
The OnlyFans thing's making a lot of noise. That's a good move, bro. I like that.
So yes, so we have a bunch of investors, business owners, like people who I think most folks would say, hey, this is what I would expect. These are people I've seen on the podcast or some of our more popular episodes, things like that. And then we have four of the top earner adult stars in history that are coming on. I don't know exactly where they rank, but maybe they're like four of the top 50 or whatever. Right. Two of them are probably top 10. And what a lot of people don't realize is these are people who have built companies, who have investment portfolios, et cetera. And so I was thinking to myself, I'm like, how can I find someone who is completely outside of like the traditional
business
and investment
community? But
it's what
you talked about. Remember being outside the box?
Correct. Yeah. And surprise people with intelligence, results, all these different things. And like really hammer home the point, like entrepreneurs and investors can come from any walk of life. And so one of the people, the guy on the panel, is actually a friend of mine from in my early 20s before he went and did all this stuff.
No way.
And so I was talking to him and he's like, dude, like there's no better industry of people who think that like they don't have any business or investment acumen. And he knows the top folks. And so we put the panel together. And look, I know when we announced it that some people weren't going to be excited and all of that. But like the fact that some people weren't going to like it was even more reason to do it, right? And so I always say, don't judge the book by its cover. Come listen to the conversation. After you listen to the conversation, if you think they're idiots and we shouldn't have done it, tell us. But before then,
I love that. Pump, favorite type of music? You mentioned Lil Wayne, rap. Who do you like the best?
I mean, everybody. Jay-Z is probably my favorite.
You have a favorite Jay-Z song? Anything that comes to mind?
Nah. I would say that the most recent thing he's put out that I really liked was not even his song, but DJ Khaled's God Did. Jay-Z's got a whole verse on there. I probably listened to that like 1,000 times.
Really?
Right. Yeah. I like a lot of his earlier stuff when it was a little bit less mainstream.
Right.
And he was kind of a little bit more raw. Lil Wayne grew up listening to a ton of his stuff. And then there's like certain songs, like I think Macklemore has done a fantastic job, probably doesn't get the respect that he deserves.
Yeah, because he goes a little funny and stuff like that.
And then there's this guy, he's going to laugh that I mentioned him, but there's this guy, Mike Studd, who played
ex-Duke baseball player. Yeah.
So I think he goes Just Mike.
Just
or,
Mike.
Or,
hey.
Or Mike.
Yeah, Just
it
Mike.
Just
yeah,
Mike.
Yeah,
and
just
his
Mike.
Handles are like, it's Just Mike. And I love his stuff for three reasons. One, I've trained my daughter. I turn it on. She starts dancing. She loves it, right?
Nice.
So like, okay, cool. We're good there. Two is I actually enjoy the music. It's kind of very uplifting and positive and all that kind of stuff. But the third thing is he's innovating around the business model of music. So it's a lot of subscription. It's a lot of he goes direct. He records all of the music wherever he is. So if he's in Airbnb, if he's at home, if he's in a hotel room, whatever, he brings basically the ability to record there.
I love that.
And he doesn't go to the studio. He's just like, yo, when creativity strikes,
let's
I
go.
Fucking record,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And then he'll put out songs. Like he may just drop a random song. He doesn't have necessarily like, here's an entire album. I put it together. I've got a label. We're going to put it out. Like, No, he's just like, yo, I'm going straight to the fans. And then you look, and he sells out his concerts and shows, and he's just building this whole movement of people. And it's this magical thing of, like, you got to have somebody who's talented. You got to have somebody who understands the internet and kind of the digital tools and all that stuff.
Right.
But you also got to have somebody who's willing to take risk. And he was willing to do this before pretty much anybody else was willing to do it, and it's working. And now I think other artists are going to start being like,
start doing that.
I want to do that. I want to bet on myself.
Yeah,
I want to have the direct connection. That's way more powerful over the long run than working with the label.
Which is what the comedians are doing. Our boy Andrew Schultz did the same thing with YouTube.
Correct.
And all that stuff, which is amazing. I do the same thing with my speaking too. Like what you said, I literally will ask the person, oh, you booked me to speak, perfect. Give me any points, whatever. And then I just go, I don't have notes or anything.
Yes,
I just
go
right from the heart. So it seems more natural, you know, that you don't have to like read off of it and stuff like that. Pomp, you're the guy, man. I am so grateful you took the time to do this, dude. You're a man of your word. I'm such a fan of yours, and any help I can be. I always ask the guests at the end, man, one question for me. Anything I can help you with? One question.
One question? Do you know the cheat code in Ken Griffey Baseball and Sega Genesis or Nintendo 64?
No, but I
know. Nintendo 64?
I didn't play. I didn't have. Here's my story
I'd
video games.
You then.
Dude, you destroyed me. You destroyed me. I do know that this is before your time. How about this? Do you know, nobody in this room is going to know this. Do you know up, up, down, down, left, right, BA, BA, select, start? Do you know that?
I don't know what that one specifically is, but that's basically a
that's Contra. That's Contra, which is an old Nintendo game.
Yeah,
kind of
yeah.
Like Mike Tyson was 007. That was a code.
The first game we ever had was the duck shooting game in
Duck
Hunt. Nintendo.
Duck Hunt.
Hunt. Yeah, with a little gun or whatever.
So I skipped all that because my dad didn't believe in any of that. So I had to go to my neighbor's house to do that. But
yeah, we had that. Then we had Sega Genesis, and we had like two games.
Shinobi was the big Sega Genesis game. That was the Chinese... the ninja guy.
Yeah.
That was
big. We were obsessed with those. And then Nintendo 64, I remember my brothers and I, we would literally get in fist fights over Ken Griffey Jr. baseball.
That was the thing, huh? The Ken Griffey Jr. baseball. Yeah. Do you still play video games now?
Because we had the cheat codes. We would go on the
internet. Still play now or no?
Nah, I don't really play. You don't have time for that, huh? You're reading. If I've thought multiple times about getting some sort of video game system for the office, but literally I would do no work and neither would anybody else, so we're gonna keep that out of
here. Dude, I agree with that. That's like putting like
these guys are all laughing. They're like, yo, man, that sounds awesome.
That's like these D1 programs that have like ping pong thing in the thing. Yeah. All that's distraction, bro. We gotta attack.
In college, we had a locker room, we had a weight room, and we had the showers, and we had the medical area. And
dude, you gotta see now. You gotta see. You see the locker rooms now?
Yo, I see the videos.
It is crazy. Pomp, you're the man, dude. Thank you so much. Thank you for having me here.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.